Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We know that when it comes to voting behavior, some people, when they go to the polls, are solidly partisan in the way that they vote and the way they think of themselves. There are some people that are Democrats no matter what, and some people who are Republicans no matter what. We also know that there are significant numbers of Americans who can and have gone either way in elections, and the parties know that they cannot win national elections only by turning out their base. They know that they have to capture these swing voters. For some decades now, the most significant block of swing voters have been working-class Americans, and certainly in this election, as in others, both parties are working hard to secure their votes. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about how the Republican Party can capture enough swing voters to secure the White House this year. And we have as our guests two political writers. They both work for The Atlantic magazine. The two guests are Ross Douthat. He is senior editor at The Atlantic. And Raihan Salam. He is associate editor at The Atlantic. He is also a fellow at the New America Foundation. And the two of them together are the authors of a new book that we'll be talking about. The title of their book is Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. That's the subtitle. Doubleday is the publisher. The book is out now in a bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. And also on this program, of course, as always, we welcome questions and comments. We hope that people will keep their questions and comments brief just so we can get a moving along here and get as many different people as possible. But certainly, callers are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. That's the local number. We do also have a toll-free line, though, if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the Internet, 800-222-9455 is the number. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Douthat, hello.
Hello, thanks for having us.
Well, thank you. Am I pronouncing your name correctly, by the way?
You are, yeah. As long as you get the Dow part of it right, you really can't go wrong.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for being with us, and also Mr. Salam.
Hi.
Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
I'd like to maybe just get your impressions of where we are right at the moment. Certainly, we know that the approval ratings for the Bush administration are quite low. We know that it seems that the emerging issues now are going to be domestic and economic ones. That seems to be the things that people are worried about the most. For either for good or ill, the president ends up getting the blame if things are not going well. And traditionally, I think that people, when it comes to economic issues, have looked to the Democratic Party. And the other big issues, if it's security issues, people tend to gravitate toward the Republicans. If it's domestic and economic, tends to go towards the Democrats. So all of that should argue for a lock by the Democrats on the race for this year. And that's not the way it looks. I'm not sure what the latest polls say, but certainly there have been some that have said, well, you know, we really don't know. It could go either way. What do you think is going on here this year? What are the dynamics that are going into this race for the White House? And Ross, why don't you start?
Sure. I mean, I think that the Democrats remain in, broadly speaking, a very favorable position for precisely the reasons that you just laid out. You know, this is an election that's turning potentially from foreign to domestic issues, especially compared to 2004, which was much more of a foreign policy election. And it is an election that's happening in the teeth of a potential recession where you have an enormously unpopular GOP incumbent. And if you look at the generic ballot where people are asked to choose between Democrats and Republicans and are asked to identify with one party or the other, for a while now, the Democrats have been doing very well on that ballot, and in terms of party identification, Democrats have been doing pretty well, and Republicans have been plummeting. That's reversed itself a tiny bit recently, but the overall trends are still pretty favorable to the Democrats. What you do see, though, in the presidential race especially, is a situation where Barack Obama is running behind the generic Democrat on the ballot. So what that means is if you conduct a poll and say, would you prefer a Democrat or a Republican in 2008, the Democrat trounces the Republican. If you then conduct the poll and say, do you prefer Barack Obama or John McCain, Obama tends to be ahead even now in the polls, but his lead tends to be in the 2 to 3 to 4 point range. It tends to drop if you poll likely voters as opposed to all voters. I think there are a couple things going on here, and one of them is that John McCain has historically been very successfully branded as a different kind of Republican, as a maverick, as someone who isn't that closely tied to the Bush administration especially and to Republican orthodoxy more generally. And that gives him an edge that your average Republican wouldn't have in what could be a bad year for Republicans. And then you also have the fact that, you know, Barack Obama, I think, has a lot of weaknesses as a candidate that tend to reduce his appeal compared to a generic Democrat. And some of these are obvious things. I mean, I think, you know, running for president with the name Barack Hussein Obama and, you know, with his background and so on is always going to make, you know, there's always going to be a certain hurdle to get over just purely for racial and cultural reasons. But I think he's also sort of displayed weaknesses as a politician, especially in the last couple months, in his handling of everything from, you know, the debate over gas prices to I think there were some real missteps in his overseas trip, particularly the decision to hold the huge rally in Berlin, which sort of set him up, I think, to be mocked fairly effectively by the Republicans. So anyway, so that's sort of my sketch of where things stand.
Okay. Oh, well, Mr. Salama, would you like to add anything to that?
No, I think that is a very, very thorough portrait. Karl Rove mentioned in the Wall Street Journal the other day that Gallup now believes there to be 23% of the electorate that counts as swing voters. The last time around, the number was half that. So I think we have a very, very fluid election, and I think that we're going to see a lot of surprises between now and November.
Well, then let's go to talk about the people that we're talking about, the American working class. And I'm sure that when people hear that terminology, I'm not exactly sure who they're going to think of, whether they're going to think of themselves, whether they're going to think of somebody else. When you talk about working class Americans, what exactly do you mean by that?
Raihan, you want to take that?
Sure. We're talking about non-college educated Americans. So that's a pretty big category. And in particular, we're focused on white non-college educated Americans. Really, we aim the agenda at a broader group, including non-white Americans. But the truth is that the message of the Republican Party has resonated more with white non-college educated Americans who have been an overwhelmingly large share of the electorate for a really long time. In 1940, this was bigger than 80% of the electorate. Now it's just under 50% at 48%. It still constitutes the lion's share of voters, and yet it's a group that people don't always pay as close attention to as they should in terms of, you know, where they fit politically, what their needs are. The Republican Party is really connected with these voters on the basis of their cultural aspirations, but not always on the basis of their emerging economic anxieties. It's also worth noting that Republicans have generally done well with working class voters who felt like they've been flourishing, who felt like they've, you know, been succeeding in the market economy. They're usually from two-parent families. They're usually the winners from economic change. But now the number of people who think of themselves as being in the winner circle is shrinking because of the sense that, you know, even if you do work hard and play by the rules, you aren't necessarily going to thrive economically. And, you know, more to the point, your children might not. The reason why education is the really essential thing is that, you know, you could be a relatively prosperous person who didn't have a college education and not have the confidence that your children will be able to have the same kind of life. It's a kind of capital that, you know, is very difficult and time-consuming to acquire, and it plays a kind of different role than, you know, income alone, because it actually gives you some level of flexibility in your working life. And I think that that's the real concern, the pace of change.
I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more, one or the other, both of you, having you talk a little bit more about what it is that this block of voters think about, what it is they think are important. Because here, again, we're talking about people who these could well have been the people that were important in electing George Bush, and yet at the same time in the last, in the midterm elections, turned against the Republicans so that we got a majority, a Democratic majority in Congress. So they could have voted for a Democrat in Congress there. They could have voted for George Bush before that. They might even indeed have voted for Bill Clinton, but before that they might have voted for Ronald Reagan. And it seems really, to me, kind of confusing why it is they should be that amenable to parties that seem to really have very different agendas.
Well, I think, I mean, part of what's going on here is that the big challenges facing working class America, especially since the 1970s, are challenges that happen at the intersection of culture and economics, which is sort of a tangled place. And so it's a place where it makes sense that the two parties would, you know, in different ways appeal to those voters. So what I mean by that is that, for instance, if you look at something like, you know, the growth of inequality, economic inequality in American life, and perhaps, you know, there's some evidence that social mobility has declined somewhat, you know, basically the idea being that it's a little harder to get ahead in America than it was 30 years ago, right? Now, that's an economic issue, in a sense, and it's an economic challenge for these voters, and that's an issue the Democrats are very comfortable talking about. But the other thing that's going on there is that a large driver of economic inequality in American life is cultural breakdown and specifically family breakdown. If you go back to the 1950s and compare rates of divorce, rates of out-of-wedlock births, and so on across social classes, the rich, the middle class, the working class, the poor, were all getting married and divorced and having kids out of wedlock at about the same rates. And then flash forward to the present, and the upper middle class and the wealthy in America are still behaving, in a sense, like 1950s bourgeois, like father knows best. They're, you know, have very low divorce rates, very low illegitimacy rates, and they tend to live and inhabit a world of stable family life. But working class Americans inhabit a much more disrupted world, a world where divorce is much more common, where illegitimacy is much more common, and so on. And so in that sense, they're facing a challenge that is cultural and has to do with family breakdown. And in that sense, the Republican message of family values and social conservatism tends to resonate. So you can see, you know, these problems are intertwined, and the Democrats sometimes seem to have a piece of it, and the Republicans sometimes seem to have a piece of it. But it makes sense in a way that people would swing back and forth, because it is, you know, these are very complicated challenges, and they're hard for political parties to get their arms around.
Let me just quickly introduce again the guests for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Ross Douthat. He is senior editor at The Atlantic, and also Raihan Salam. He is associate editor at The Atlantic, also a fellow at the New America Foundation. They are together the authors of a recently published book. The title is Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. That's the subtitle. It's published by Doubleday, and it looks at the voting behavior of this big block of Americans, working class Americans, who from election to election might in one election vote Democratic and they might in the next vote Republican. And as we know, both parties are very interested in trying to get the votes of working class Americans, because they know that, as I said at the beginning, you can't just win with your base. You got to get the people who are amenable to go either way. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that that people would have heard your the last comments you made there about the growth of inequality and the factors that contribute to that, and people on the left have a completely different way of looking at this. And they, in fact, would say if there's inequality, that may have to do with economic factors that's beyond anybody's control, but it may also have to do with deliberate kinds of policy positions that have been taken and executed by the Republicans. And again, for good or ill, for better or worse, people don't think of the Republican Party as being the party of the working person. They think of it as being the party of the wealthy. And how do you what do you do with, or how do you respond to that basic issue? That people have said that, you know, what Republicans have done well by the people on the top end of the income spectrum, but not so well on everybody else.
The historian Charles Beard, who is from Wisconsin, of course, he had a phrase called the devil theory of American politics. If you just get rid of all of the devils, then everything's going to be great, whether or not it's the members of a corrupt political party, whether it's a group of malefactors of great wealth who are pulling the strings from behind the scenes. It's a very attractive idea because it's, you know, very simple. Just get rid of the devils and things will be great. The problem is, if you look at Germany, for example, where the Republican Party has not been in power, they have the exact same pre-tax inequality rates that the United States does right now. And I think that when you're looking at Western Europe more broadly, where where you have what appear to be better inequality pictures, part of it is a function of a different skill distribution. That is, our college education attainment rates are higher than theirs now. They're catching up, by the way, and younger generations, they're actually ahead of us. But in terms of the overall distribution of the workforce, they're actually behind us. And as they catch up, that's going to change. A lot of the things that are driving increased inequality are demographic. When you have a more educated population, you have more wage dispersion. You have more of a mix of outcomes. You have, for example, some people who decide, I have a college education, I want to become an investment banker. You have others who decide, I want to become a social worker. Also, when you have an older population, that means there's more time for people's economic circumstances to diverge. There are a lot of things that are really structural, also in terms of, you know, the benefits that accrue to people with different levels of education. If you look at the big winners in the past decade, they've been people with JDs and MBAs. And I think that one of the splits between the two parties is between a party that's oriented toward, you know, small business people, toward people who are managers, within large-scale corporate organizations. And then you have another part of the economy where you have people who are similarly affluent and well-educated, but they are actually part of larger organizations that are insulated from things like lawsuits. You have, you know, academics, you have social workers, you have a lot of people who are part of large administrative bureaucracies. They have a very different perspective on the economy despite the fact that they have similar incomes. So I think it's a much, much more complicated picture than one party or another party. In fact, there are people on the left of the Democratic Party who also blame Bill Clinton because of the kind of tax and spending policies that he pursued in the 1990s. I think that, you know, again, there's a tendency to want to point, one's finger at one political party or another. And I think the Republican Party has made some very big mistakes, particularly during the Bush years. But unfortunately, I mean, this is a tangle of issues that goes to a lot of the intimate choices and decisions that we make. It really is rooted in the kind of relationships that people have. It's rooted in a lot of decisions that aren't necessarily susceptible to government, but it's something that government might be able to help with, and an area where government might be able to do a better job, and that's true of both Republicans and Democrats. So unfortunately, I think the devil theory doesn't actually hold in this case.
I would also say that, you know, one thing that's going on is that it's definitely the case that the Republican Party, especially since Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, has championed policies that promote, you know, that take economic growth as their ultimate goal, as the most important thing for the American economy. And there's a reason for that, which is to say that, you know, if you look back to the debates that people were having in the 1970s, they tended to be debates about how do we divide up this stagnating or shrinking pie. And the inside of Reagan and the 80s Republicans was that, you know, the most important thing to do is to make sure that the pie keeps growing before we get into debates about how we divide things up. And I mean, you know, a lot of the kind of equality that was possible in 1950s America was made possible by the fact that the U.S. simply didn't have any economic competitors in that era. There, you know, Europe had been broken. China and Japan and all of those countries hadn't yet started their rise to economic prominence. And so the U.S., for instance, could afford to have incredibly heavy unionization because our auto manufacturers weren't competing with Japanese auto manufacturers. And that was true across the board. And so there is a sense in which a certain amount of economic inequality has become the price that we pay for having the more dynamic economy that's necessary to compete in a more competitive global environment. Now, again, as Ryan said, and I agree, I think that, you know, we've reached a point where both Democrats and especially Republicans need to think about some of the costs of this and, you know, some of the problems associated with it and do something to, you know, create a more equal capitalism. That's a term that Jim Manzi, one of our fellow conservatives, have used. And I think that this is something Republicans haven't thought through enough at all. But there is a sense in, you know, there are reasons that conservatives have been pursuing these kind of pro-growth policies, and they don't just have to do with trying to, you know, enrich the already rich. They have to do with trying to keep America competitive in a very different world from the world of 1955.
We have a caller here. Let's bring him into the conversation. Somebody calling from Tolono, and they're on a cell phone. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good.
Great show. Your guests are very eloquent, and I like that very much. I'm a swing voter, and I am college educated, so I'm not technically part of that working class that you were talking about. I was wondering, I know how I go about doing this, but I was kind of wondering about, is there some sort of an analysis that's been done that shows how swing voters get their information and make their decisions on who to vote for, a president or a local congressperson or whatever? The reason I'm asking is because, you know, I would tend to watch the Jim Lehrer report, or I would read the New York Times online or something like that. I might watch the debates and then make decisions based on how people present themselves and what their ideas are and how they present their solutions and things of that nature. And I could go either way. I'm not a registered Democrat or a Republican, but I would choose my candidate based on criteria that I've set for myself, and I get my information from various sources, but really none of them like network type things. So just curious, has there been any studies?
There's been a ton of work on this stuff, on the idea of low-information voters.
I'm going to hang up and listen to your reply then.
Okay. Well, yeah, thanks for the call.
There's been a lot of research done on so-called low-information voters, and it's true that it's actually college graduates, men, baby boomers, who tend to cluster as high-knowledge voters. But it's interesting because, you know, actually low-information voters, tend to rely on a different set of cues, and they tend to have there's a wonderful article in The Nation by Chris Hayes about this phenomenon of relatively low-information voters who do tend to cluster with the undecided. But what's interesting is that high-knowledge voters tend to be a lot more ideological. They tend to be a lot more ideological and less pragmatic. And actually, over time, when you're an ideological voter, you actually tend not to evaluate things on a case-by-case basis based on all that knowledge you're accruing, but rather you fit that knowledge that you're accruing into an ideological framework. So I think that there's a tendency to think, hey, you know, it's great. I'm a high-knowledge voter, and that's a good thing. I'm sort of relatively affluent and educated, and if only everyone were like me. But actually, there are new kind of heuristics, and there are new handicaps that are introduced when you're a high-knowledge voter, too. So I think that, you know, it's... And when you're looking at, you know, so-called low-information voters, the kind of things they're looking at, you know, they're looking at character, they're looking at the state of the economy and whether or not the incumbent party is, you know, in line with, you know, their own economic well-being, that kind of thing. I mean, these are, you know, kind of very broad things, and they're not necessarily terribly specific. They don't have a lot of, you know, data about rich causality, you know, which policies are causing which outcomes. But, you know, they're not a crazy way to actually guide political decisions all the time. So I think that, you know, I would be hesitant before we criticize people too strongly because, again, people have lives. You know, they have children, they have jobs they have to take care of. So I think that, you know, I'm reluctant to criticize people too much for not paying too close attention to the issues.
I mean, the other thing, and this goes to, I think, the caller's point about looking for information sources. And you do have a very interesting phenomenon that hasn't worked itself out yet, where, you know, the biggest phenomenon in the media landscape is the decline of these sort of old, established, at least theoretically nonpartisan, though in practice they tended to lean slightly to the left, institutions. The decline of the major broadcast networks, the decline of the major newspapers, and the rise of a much more fractured, fragmented, and often partisan media environment. And you have a situation in which there are actually many, many, many more sources of information about politics today than probably at any point in American history. I mean, you just go on the internet and look at the amount of coverage devoted, especially to national politics. It's incredible. But what's disappeared for a lot of people, and especially in my and Ryan's generation, are the filters that people used to use. And, you know, there are some filters now growing up on the internet. I mean, if you look at the success of, like, the Huffington Post, for instance, that's a sort of liberal filter for the news that's been very successful. But, you know, the days when people trusted Walter Cronkite to effectively filter the news for them are gone. And so I think we're going to see a lot more wild diversity in how people get their news. And you're going to have voters who are, you know, groups of voters who are voting based on completely different paradigms, completely different information flows, and so on.
I guess I still find myself wondering whether, even now that we have all these outlets for information and people putting that out there, that there's still the blogosphere does tend to be partisan, and I still wonder whether people, they're seeking out these novel sources of information, but are they seeking out sources that challenge what they already think, or are they basically settling in with sources that that they're comfortable with because they read what's there and they say, oh yeah, okay, I get that, I agree with that, that's my worldview.
I think there's
too
a little bit of both. I think that actually the kind of readers who are consuming blogs are actually a little bit more inclined than people thought to seek different views. But I also think that when you're talking about, you know, readers of blogs, these high knowledge voters, they're you know, a relatively small slice of the population that is, again, very ideological. So I don't think they're really people who, even if they are seeking out, you know, clashing views, even if they are seeking out things that are going to challenge their worldviews, the way that I think that people actually take on an ideology, take on a worldview, is actually through their network of friends and family members. It's something that is, this is why, like, you know, the partisan views that you form at a relatively young age really stay with you. For example, the most heavily Republican group in the country, it's people who came of age during the Reagan years. Mm-hmm. And they still have that view of the Republican Party as the party of economic optimism, the forward-looking party, the party that was frankly cool. And I think that, you know, when you're looking at the partisan landscape right now, it's certainly possible that young people who are Democrats today will change their minds as they, you know, come to own small businesses, as they come to have different economic experiences. But there's going to be a real gut level at which the failures of the Bush administration are going to have a permanent taint on the Republican brand for a long time, certainly with our generation.
Yeah. Just very quickly, let me again introduce the two guests. Ross Douthat, he's a senior editor at The Atlantic, and Raihan Salam is a associate editor, also at The Atlantic, and a fellow at the New America Foundation. The two of them together are authors of the book Grand New Party. The subtitle is How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. It's published by Doubleday. Your intent with the book, obviously, clearly, is to both have some criticism for the party, for the Republican Party, and the positions that it has taken, particularly recently, and also then to recommend some new directions. I want to make sure we do talk about new directions, but since one of you said that you felt that the Republican Party had made some big mistakes, particularly during the Bush years. Maybe run that list down for me, at least mention a couple of things where you think that the party made a big mistake.
Well, I think there was a huge strategic mistake in forgetting about the domestic issues that you were talking about, forgetting about their central importance. I think that, you know, in truth, the Bush administration did actually do some good on the domestic front. For example, if you look at the Medicare prescription drug benefit, this is something that proved very controversial, particularly with a lot of small government conservatives. It's also something that's proved, you know, pretty popular and also pretty successful in terms of delivering the outcome that a lot of American voters wanted. The problem is that it was seen as an entering wedge to reform the broader healthcare system and also Medicare and Medicaid more broadly, and that didn't end up happening because Bush squandered so much political capital pursuing, you know, other things that were really clashing against the interests of his base, or certainly in terms of perception. I think that, you know, it was Bill Clinton pursued healthcare reform before pursuing welfare reform, and the political analyst Mickey Kaus very astutely said he should have done the opposite. He should have gone with welfare reform first to demonstrate that he was a different kind of Democrat, to demonstrate that he wanted to reform the welfare state along lines that really put the welfare state in line with the moral values of working class people and, you know, of the American electorate more broadly. President Bush should have done something similar. He should have sought out some kind of domestic reform project that would have demonstrated that, you know, look, I'm a Republican, but I really care about these domestic issues. There are distinctive conservative pro-market solutions that can deliver better outcomes for the American people. And we're going to roll up our shirt sleeves, we're going to spend money if we need to, and we're going to make that happen. And if you had done that first, and then you had gone on to entitlement reform, I think you would have seen a very different political landscape. It's easy for us to say this, because when you're actually in a White House, it's very reactive, it's very tough, and they, of course, had, you know, two wars to manage and to launch, you know, which was incredibly time-consuming. But I think that had they had a broader focus on, you know, domestic reformism, had they pushed those issues more strongly, I think you would have seen the Republican Party really emerge as a solid, stable national majority.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, to pick up on that point, I mean, I think the big choice that the Bush administration made on domestic policy was the choice to make. You know, after the 2004 election, when there was, for the first time really since 9/11, there was a perception that, you know, Bush had real political capital to work with. Obviously, he had political capital immediately after 9/11, but that was spent on the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. But after 2004, you know, he has a larger Republican majority in Congress. He doesn't have a huge mandate, but he has some kind of mandate. And the decision was made to push Social Security reform, which, you know, is a, you know, an important cause, and obviously one that conservatives have spent a lot of time thinking about, but it's One, it's a long-range problem. Two, it's a problem that goes straight to voters' fears about Republicans, that they're, you know, just out to abolish the New Deal and sort of roll back what FDR did, you know, let alone what LBJ did. And you know, had there been a choice, like if you look at the healthcare reform that John McCain is pushing somewhat ineffectively now, but is you know a sort of attempt to promote a more free market reform of the healthcare system that actually lowers costs for most Americans. If Bush had championed something like that and had spent his political capital on something like that and had succeeded, rather than pushing for Social Security reform and failing, the landscape of his second term would have looked completely different. And a lot of what happened thereafter was, I think, you know, something that a lot of small government conservatives have rightly criticized, which is the tendency, and this is just a tendency inherent in being a pro-market party, people tend to get confused and think that being pro-market just means being pro-business. And so you end up with, you know, whether it's the energy bill or the transportation bill or what have you, these sort of omnibus packages of legislation that were, you know, essentially just often large-scale corporate welfare and didn't address the concerns that a lot of Americans have, you know, whether it's about energy prices or our crumbling transportation infrastructure or what have you.
I'll just note that Bush really did try to push some health care reforms along the lines that McCain pushed. If you look at his State of the Union address in 2006, the problem is that he didn't lay the groundwork for it.
Well, and it was too late. I mean, by 06, he was...
Yeah, no, I certainly think you should have pursued it in the first term. Yeah, definitely.
Well, we have a number of callers here. We're moving into our last 15 minutes, so we'll try to get in as many folks as possible, and we'll start in again with someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Yes, the Medicare drug bill has a couple of huge flaws in it. Number one, it's a multi-billion dollar program with no funding mechanism. Number two, let me go on here now. The statement you made in regards to the host party being the party of the rich, you went back to the 1980s, almost 30 years ago, you went over to Germany, and I think you danced around the question. I don't think that the public's buying it. I'm certainly not buying it, and I think you'll see that in the presidential election. Oh, the second part of the Medicare thing was that, I'm getting on in age because I'm forgetting again, but he could have save money by volume buying, but no. In his obsequies to big business, he didn't want to shave a penny off their profits, so he did not ask for a volume purchase and a more economical price to the citizenry. So thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, you can go at that any way you like.
Yeah, I just don't think that's actually a fair characterization of the bill. I think it's true that it didn't actually adequately address the funding side, and I think that that would require some sort of broader system-wide reform, but I think that it actually did come under budget estimates, and I think that it has been broadly successful. I mean, the basic idea was to create something that would actually, you know, give recipients more choice, and in terms of, you know, the volume buying piece of it, I think that, you know, that's a thorny issue because, to some extent, the United States is subsidizing the rest of the world and permitting, innovation to happen in pharmaceutical drugs. And I think that, you know, there might be better ways to do that, for example, by having the federal government purchase patents and then, you know, have drugs produced, kind of in the free market rather than through patent monopolies. But I think that, you know, that requires some kind of broader structural reform, too. And the public is crying out for some, you know, way to address the prescription drug lacuna in the program, and I think that that was done, and that was done under cost, that was done in a pretty successful way. It's much more expensive than we can afford without fixing the funding mechanism, that's true, but I think that the characterization was a little off.
To the point about the GOP, you know, being the party of the rich, I mean, I think both political parties are, in some sense, the party of the rich, because both of them depend, you know, in many cases on rich donors for their funding, and that's always been a feature of American politics, and it's a feature of it now. I think if you look, though, at, you know, increasingly the Democratic Party is, in fact, in terms of who's giving to the Democrats and where they're drawing their support from, the Democratic Party tends to be now the party of the very rich and the party of the lower middle class and the poor, and the Republican Party tends to be the party of the people in the middle, and that's increasingly, I think, the defining feature of American political life.
Well, let's go to Kankakee next. First we go to Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. There are a couple of comments I just have to make, because you slid over this, just saying that you thought that the major media leaned to the left. Well, that's a big lie. It's been touted over and over, and it's just not true. If you look at what's really happening in big media, it's run by big corporations, and they give the big corporate lie or the big corporate message over and over, and it certainly does not lean to the left. The next thing I want to say is that Republicans have been running for, since Reagan, that government is not the solution, government is the problem. So Republicans have picked this up and have taken it and have gotten themselves elected by all sorts of nefarious means. And when you mentioned Karl Rove, my hackles went up because Karl Rove should be behind bars and not be writing for any major publications. And the third thing I want to say is that because Republicans run on the notion that government is the problem, they have tended to outsource all of our governments to corporations instead of taking up the issues of serving the people, the corporations for whom all of these outsourcing or the contracting for all of our government, many, many of our government duties have been outsourced to major corporations, and their bottom line is to make profit for their shareholders and not to serve the public and the people of the United States. I'd like your comments on that. Thanks.
I'd love to respond to that. I mean, the first thing is that if you look at MTV, which is owned by a big corporation, Viacom, if you look at their news, I'd say it leans to the left, and I'd say that that is not the point of view of Sumner Redstone, the guy who is the CEO of Viacom, because, again, you're not reflecting the views of the heads of these corporations. You're reflecting the views that sell, views that resonate with the public. I worked in the news media for a long period of time, and I agree that the media is not reflexively left-wing. It's left-wing in some regards, it's right-wing in other regards, and also the media is pretty diverse. That's a very good and encouraging thing that's happened. That's one reason why it's great that we have NPR. It's great that we have talk radio as well. It's great that we have this diversity so that people can find their niche. So I think that that's a simplification and a mischaracterization. And as to the issue of outsourcing and the issue of introducing gasp, how could we, the issue of introducing competition and market competition into providing certain public services, I think it's something that a lot of Democrats have done. It's something that Bill Clinton did, and in the course of doing it, he actually really did reduce the burden on taxpayers and did a tremendous job of delivering services to people who need them. I think you've seen this happen in a very bipartisan way. You've seen it happen with socialist governments in Europe that have also done a lot of this kind of outsourcing. So I think that to say that it's a distinctively Republican thing is wrong. To say that it's a bad thing is also wrong. In fact, I would love it if Republicans were the only party that had the brilliant idea of seeing to it that the people who deliver the services cheapest and best are the ones who do it. I'd say that there is sometimes corruption in the way this happens, and I think it needs to be rooted out. But I think, again, that's a pretty serious mischaracterization. So I think that, in terms of trying to draw these bright lines between Republicans are devils, Democrats are angels, I think that it's going to mislead us a lot of the time, because there are some Democrats who are angels, definitely, some who are devils. The same goes on the Republican side. So I think that, we should have a slightly more complicated view of the political landscape.
I'm interested in having you address the other piece, and this certainly does seem to be true that for some time now, or at least going back to Reagan and perhaps also Newt Gingrich, Republicans ran against the government. They did say government was too big, that it was too intrusive in our lives. They did say things
except
like government's
not
the
state and local level. Tommy Thompson, in Wisconsin, yeah, for example, or if you're looking at Rudy Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani did want to cut government waste. He wanted to introduce competition, but he also recognized there are some things you need the government to do. You need the government to fight crime, and you need the government to, be sure that it acts as a safety net. I think that there are a lot of Republicans who believe that, and the Republicans who don't. And the Republicans who don't are being marginalized, and they're having a tough time. And I think the Republicans who believe that you need to have a reforming, capable, effective, competent government are the ones who are going to be the Republicans of the future, and they're the Republicans who have already really flourished at the state and local level.
Well, and the other thing, I mean, yes, it's true that, obviously, the Republican Party tends to be the party of limited government and the party that's more likely to be in favor of cutting government than Democrats. That's been the case, and it's always going to be the case to some extent. But if you look back at, you know, even Ronald Reagan in his famous line about government not being the solution, government being the problem, the actual text of the speech reads, in the present crisis, government is not the solution, government is the problem. And Reagan goes on to say, what we need, you know, he says, to make it clear, my intention is not to abolish government, rather it's to make it work with us rather than against us, to have it stand at our side rather than ride at our back. And part of our argument in the book is that there's this real tradition in conservative governance that runs from Reagan through people like Gingrich and Thompson at the state and local level. And yes, even including, you know, if you look back at the Gingrich era contract with America, that was not a document that was proposing massive cuts in the federal government. It was a document that was proposing targeted reforms to improve crime fighting, targeting tax cuts to families, improving accountability, streamlining government, and so on. So yes, to the extent that Republicans just run against the government and say, you know, we need to drown it in a bathtub, as the conservative activist Grover Norquist likes to say, that message isn't going to resonate with the American people, and it isn't actually the way Republicans have tended to govern over the past 25 years.
All right, let's talk with someone in Kankakee. This is our line four. Hello.
Good morning. Uh-huh. Good morning, gentlemen. Imagine my surprise when I turn on the radio and my two favorite Tories are on public radio here. And this may or may not be good news for you guys, though, since I'm pretty much in the progressive side of things. David, you talked about some folks not getting their political nourishment from balanced sources. And I think that you can feel a little easier about that, because I watch both sides. If you're going to stay informed, you have to know what each side is saying about each other. I think that you're safe in thinking that a lot of people are looking for balanced answers. For the two gentlemen, I really enjoy both of your work on Blogging Heads. And Blogging Heads itself, I think, is just a marvelous little instrument. And I wonder if you guys would talk about the future of this kind of media, this kind of political expression, the Blogging Heads TV.
Sure. I mean, I for viewers who, and listeners, I imagine most listeners don't know what Blogging Heads TV is. Basically, it's a online political talk show that tries to bring together pairings of usually bloggers, but also other journalists, writers, intellectuals, and so on, and just put them on the phone with each other, each one with a video camera, and let them talk. And I think it is, you know, I think there are a lot of weaknesses in the world of internet journalism and the world of blogging. It tends to be very reactive. It tends to favor quantity over quality and short posts over long posts and so on. But there's also real promise. And I think if you look at something like Blogging Heads, for instance, and compare it to cable political talk shows, right? If you watch a cable news political talk show, the emphasis there is always on the soundbite. It's always on bringing someone on who will talk for 30 seconds about something or say something extreme and get into a big fight and so on. And there are economic reasons for that. You need that to make the shows entertaining and to build the kind of audiences that cable news depends on. But the internet doesn't depend on those kind of huge audiences. It can produce more niche products. And so on the internet, it turns out to be actually sustainable to, instead of having two talking heads shouting at each other for 5 minutes, you can have two people having, you know, what is sometimes an incomprehensible, but often hopefully a lucid and interesting extended conversation about politics. So I think that, obviously I'm biased. I go on Blogging Heads from time to time, or more than from time to time. But I think the caller is absolutely right that there's a lot of promise in some of these technologies to have more serious, sustained conversations about politics than often exist on television these days.
Thanks a lot, boy.
All right. Well, thank you. We're getting short on time here, and in the few minutes that we have, one thing that I want to make sure that I do is to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about your recommendations, that what you're suggesting that the Republican Party should do in order to better address the needs of working class Americans. Just give us the thumbnail of what it is that you're proposing.
Should I take it,
yeah,
Raihan? I mean, I think the thumbnail version is basically that, look looking at policies that address what I talked about earlier, that intersection of family breakdown and economic dislocation. And essentially, you know, we frame a lot of our policy proposals around attempting to strengthen the American family and basically putting a little more meat on the bones of conservative arguments about the importance of families. And so our ideas on that front range from, you know, making the tax code more family friendly so it's easier for parents to make investments in their children, make investments in the future. Conservatives have always been in favor of keeping taxes low on investment, and part of what we're arguing is that we need to start thinking about raising a family as important a form of investment as starting a business, but also policies that make work-life balance easier, so it's easier for parents and especially mothers to move in and out of the workforce when they want to, when they have kids, policies that make healthcare portable, so families especially don't have to worry about losing coverage when they shift from job to job, new anti-poverty proposals that try and build on some of the successes of welfare reform and do more. You know, we have, it's sort of a long-range idea, but for a proposal of wage subsidies, which would effectively be a replacement for both the minimum wage and for the current earned income tax credit, but basically policies that provide a boost to people trying to just move into the formal economy to get, you know, entry-level jobs, low-paying jobs, help those people stay in the formal economy rather than moving into the black market, you know, selling drugs, what have you, helping people move from poverty to sustainability, making especially low-income men better candidates for marriage. This is one of the big problems driving illegitimacy, especially in the inner cities, is that there just aren't enough marriageable men. So there's a whole constellation of policies, and obviously I would certainly invite listeners to purchase our book, available now on Amazon.com, but I think basically they're all built around the idea that, you know, there are things government can do, especially at the margins, to really strengthen the institutions that make prosperity and upward mobility possible in America, and the biggest of those institutions is the family.
The goal of a lot of these policies is very straightforward. I mean, some of them, you know, are more expensive than Republicans are going to be willing to sign on, at least right now. But the goal is to actually create policies that pay for themselves by actually reducing the long-term demand for government, by reducing the sources of, you know, a lot of the cost of government, namely family breakdown, namely the kind of social breakdown that you see in schools where discipline is totally absent, areas where crime is spiking. It's trying to nip these problems in the bud before they happen. And so I think that that's really the right orientation. That's the right way to think about policy. Don't look at, you know, kind of where it is right now, you know, kind of in this narrow sense that as a line item on the budget. Look at it in terms of how it's going to shape the incentives of families and of people who are, you know, trying to get the first foothold in the job market.
Hmm. We're very short on time, but I have one last caller. I wanted to try to give them a chance here in Crystal Lake. I'll have to ask you to be brief, though, because we don't have much time, but go ahead.
I think the Conservative Party meant to bankrupt our whole economy because privatizing, deregulation, allowing monopolies to get rid of competition, and there is no competition anymore. And they bankroll all these rich places, rich corporations like energy. And bank, and then we've had the already through the Conservative Party, starting with Reagan, we've had the savings and loan fiasco, and the rich benefited from that. Now we have Bear Stearns, which had a wild credit, and all these things have wrecked our economy, and getting rid of the middle class, and just making big corporations outsourcing our jobs and change in wars to replace a decent economy. This Conservative Party has ruined our country.
Well, let's get again.
I think that she should write speeches for Barack Obama. I thought that was totally splendid.
No, look, let me just take a couple examples of deregulation very quickly. Anyone who thinks that it would be good to go back to the pre-deregulation airline industry. The airline industry of the 1970s, where almost nobody could afford air travel because it was so highly regulated. Now, sure, people who could afford air travel, it was a much better experience than what we have today.
And it was Ted Kennedy, by the way, who deregulated the airlines with Jimmy Carter.
Right. I mean, deregulation was a bipartisan policy. It was one of the great bipartisan triumphs. But, you know, I mean, But if you think Republicans have wrecked the economy over the last 30 years, I invite you, by all means, return to the economy of the 1970s, where nobody could afford to fly in an airplane, where gas prices were sky high because of gas regulations. I mean, if you think gas prices are high now, imagine where they would be if we brought back the kind of regulations we have in the 1970s. I mean, look, I think what the caller is expressing is frankly a very common myth that's prevalent in especially liberal America, that the American economy has gotten vastly worse over the past 35 years. And it's just not true.
We're coming down to the point where we have to finish. Maybe we have about a minute or so left. Obviously, there's a lot of things we could talk about if we had more time. What sort of idea or thought would you just like to leave with folks?
I feel like we spend a lot of time in this interview talking about how complicated things are, which I think is, often a bad way to go about an interview and a bad way to go about selling your book. But I think it's a very important point. And I think that, if there's any thought I'd leave the audience with, it's that, we live in a time of very heightened partisan tensions, where there's a tendency for Republicans to insist that Democrats have never had a good idea in their history, and for Democrats to insist that Republicans have been, as the caller said, steadily destroying the country for the last 30 years. And I would basically invite all of our listeners to read our book and consider the possibility that, things are a lot more complicated than that. And as Ryan said, the devil theory of American politics isn't really a good way to go about analyzing things.
All right. Well, there we will leave it. And if you're interested in getting more of the thoughts of our guests, Ross Douthat and Ryan Salaam, you look for their book. The title is Grand New Party: How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. It's published by Doubleday. Ross Douthat is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and Ryan Salaam is an associate editor at The Atlantic. He's also a fellow at the New America Foundation. Mr. Douthat, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Mr. Salaam, thank you.
Thank you.